Chapter 8 John and Lisa made their way around mud puddles, cars, trucks, and two motorcycles on their way from the gumbo house and onto his truck. Now, in the dim light outside the gumbo house, John stopped and placed his arm around Lisa's shoulder. He put the remains of Filbert gently in the back seat of the truck. "Lisa, what I did was impulsive. In my mind, I knew of no other practical answer. I may have brought future abuse upon both of us." Then he pulled a blue bandana from his hip pocket to wipe tears from Lisa's eyes. "I'm so sorry that Filbert got killed. I love that little bird. He worked so hard to help us find snakes for both of us," said Lisa, in remorse for the deceased seagull. "I know that Dr. Benelli's only interest in me is for his own gratification, and I'm not interested in that kind of relationship. I've worked too long and hard to wind up as some kind of tramp employed by visitors on the streets of New Orleans. He's just a mean person. I'm a novice at nursing, but I know enough about the criminal mind to understand that he is a social misfit parading as the opposite much of the time. This whole situation has slipped up on me. I don't think that the professors in the zoology department will brand me as some kind of thug known for hurting visiting scientists. I think that Dr. Benelli has permitted his after-hours life to lead him down a precipitous path. His actions tonight went along with what I told you earlier about being an international personality." Now, 10 miles from the restaurant, John drove along at 20 miles per hour while scanning the wet asphalt road ahead of him. The half moon accentuated the steam rising from the warm road, so attractive to many different reptiles at this time of night and weather conditions. "Look, John, the road has a whole lot of frogs on it. If Filbert was still with us, he'd see all these and point them out to us by pecking at them." That somber statement from Lisa brought a note of sadness to John as he watched her point toward the road ahead when the headlights cut through the mist. Some of the frogs hopped while others sat within way of their tires. Those frogs John guided around. "It's the old predator-prey game, Lisa. The frogs are after the worms and insects, and the snakes are interested in making a meal of the frogs. Were it daytime, the red-tailed hawks would go for both the frogs and snakes. It's hard to believe that a red-tailed hawk can kill and eat a poisonous snake, but they can," said John, just as he turned the steering wheel in an attempt to spare the life of a large frog immediately in line with the left front tire. "A hawk can kill a snake, as we've seen Filbert do it. Birds of prey have terrific vision. From top of a tree, they can spot a snake. Then the hawk will swoop down and use talons and curved beak to kill the snake. You might say that the snake was bird-bit." "John, I wanted to tell Dr. Brunelli, too, that he was snake-bit while he intermittently wallowed around recuperating in front of that Coke machine. But I thought better of it. We both know that he's a dangerous man, and I thought I'd better not upset him more." "The important thing, Lisa, we don't ever want to get snake-bit. That is, of course, by a poisonous snake, those with two hypodermic fangs that inject venom from the glands on their head. Non-poisonous snakes, such as the garter snake, have several small teeth but no fangs. Those snakes can't hurt you." 2 more hours produced a corn snake and another rat snake. John placed all snakes in separate cloth collection bags. "Put your snakes in separate bags. If you don't, you could come back to lab here with only one snake," had said Dr. Bosco. "Remember, some snakes prefer another as their meal. Don't forget that. Further, a snake ingestion of another snake often takes quite some time, so you don't need to get back here and try to take back a half-ingested snake just to have the few more points that it may take to pass this course. That could be a very messy affair."
"John, I think that it's time for us to go. Thankfully, only 4 species of poisonous snakes are found in the United States: copperheads, corals, cottonmouths, and rattlesnakes."
Midnight and their snakes in bags signaled that it was time for John and Lisa to drive back to the LSU campus. "Lisa, I'll drive you by your apartment and divvy out our night's catch. I think a few more trips and we'll have our 100 points worth to pass Professor Bosco's herpetology course," said John, now feeling his eyelids getting heavy. "We have 2 rat snakes. I'll take one of them. You can have the corn snake and the other rat snake. Too bad that we didn't get the high counters, the cottonmouths," said John. The next few months turned out well for John and Lisa. Lisa completed her master's degree in nursing and got a job at the Ochsner Medical Center in New Orleans. That's when she quit waiting tables and earning tips of gratuity at Antoine's. Furthermore, she hoped that she had escaped from Andre Benelli's lecherous intentions. As for John, he settled into a workaholic mode of existence and completed the bachelor degree. He majored in biology and minored in chemistry. With full steam ahead, John entered the academic program, which combined the master's degree with a PhD.
John finished those degrees, and in May, he'd graduate with much of his work in herpetology, guided by Dr. Bosco. One fateful night, while studying for a final test in an animal physiology course, John took a few minutes' break and dropped by Lisa's apartment. When knocking on Lisa's apartment door, he turned and saw her enter the driveway and park a red Jeep, a Wrangler model. "Why the Jeep?" asked John. "I thought after you graduated and are now making real money that you'd buy a BMW. "No, I thought after you finally proposed to me last weekend, a four-wheel drive Jeep would be more practical," said Lisa. "Your old truck still has some life in it. You can use my Jeep on your long-distance field trips. We'll economize for a few months." "That's what I came by to talk to you about. Do you want a wedding with all the bells and whistles, or a simple exchange of vows at our minister's house?" "John, you should know me well enough by now that all I'm interested in is just making it legal before man and honest before God." And Lisa dropped her medical backpack, stepped to John, now standing on the sidewalk under the canopy of an oak tree, and planted a red lipstick mark on his face. "With my degree in nursing, I think that we can make a go of it. You'll get along better on your muddy field trips with students when using my Jeep than you would using a sports car. Now you know why I bought a Jeep. By the way, where do you want to go on our honeymoon?" asked John. "How about Niagara Falls? I've never been there." Lisa LaFay became Lisa LaRue on June 11, 2012, at the home of a local minister that both marriage partners knew. The minister's wife witnessed John and Lisa's lifelong commitments to each other. 2 days later, John and Lisa took a Delta flight from New Orleans to Buffalo, New York. There, John rented a blue Ford Fusion and drove to Niagara Falls. "Let's turn in Ford today and start out fresh in the morning," said John. "It's been a long day." The honeymoon night was sweet for the newlyweds, and it was 9 a.m. before John peeped through the hotel blinds and looked at his Timex. "If we're going to ride the Maid of the Mist today, we'd better jump to it," said John, as he now bleary-eyed, with a white towel wrapped around his waist, stood in front of the bathroom mirror and shaved. "How do these blue jeans look?" asked Lisa, when she did a half pirouette before another mirror. "Just right. A fashionable fit," said John, and he gave a slight chuckle. "The way I like them." "Am I about right with this blue pullover?" asked John. "Yes, and your brown belt and beige slacks make you look nice," said Lisa. "I read in the little pamphlet there on the nightstand that if we don't wear the raincoats offered, we'll come back soaked. The Maid of the Mist goes right up to the falls." She tugged on her other tennis shoe, the right one. "You know there are actually three falls, don't you?" asked John, checking out just how much Lisa had read in the pamphlet. "I know. There are the American Falls and the Horseshoe Falls. What's the other one?"
"The one that applies to us on this trip, the Bridal Veil Falls. It's the little one between the American Falls and the Horseshoe Falls."
"Let's walk slowly to the docking point. It isn't that far from where we're staying," said Lisa. "And it's a sunny day. I'd like to enjoy just a slow stroll. Remember that old tune, sweetheart, The Stroll? That tune from the 1950s? That's before we were born."
"Sure, I remember it. It's still around. It came along during the rock and roll era and the beginning of the sock hops," said John.
"On the Golden Oldies show, Chuck Willis sang that song along with C.C. Rider, written during the flapper era. But as a true Cajun, nothing compares to our chink-a-chank music."
"Listen, sweetheart, I can already hear the roar of the falls and see the mist rising in the morning sun. And the rainbow! Oh, how I love the rainbow! That is such a welcome start to a lovely day," said Lisa. "And the arrangements of the flowers and shrubbery here along the walkway add to it."
And John pulled Lisa close to him as they both slowed their pace. "Stop now." John looked Lisa straight on.
"Sweetheart, you really are a beautiful woman, and I love you dearly."
And John placed his right arm around Lisa's shoulders and slowed the advance of two other couples headed to the ticket counter. But they cared not. Those two couples were doing the same thing. All showed a heartfelt moment of special love before heading to the Bridal Veil Falls. There, many of the newly married couples renewed their vows informally while experiencing the natural spray of mist covering their hooded garments. Lisa pulled John closer, merging the mist into a tiny trickle down her raincoat. No romantic moments last forever, and the captain signaled that the Maid of the Mist must move on to the American Falls and go back to the docking point for other passengers. John looked downstream at the functional part of Niagara Falls, a hydroelectric plant providing electrical power for this portion of the state of New York. He thought that the practical result of the falls must have been worked out between the United States and Canada. Dock now, away from the deafening pounding of the water falling onto the rocks, the Maid of the Mist floated, ready to take on the latest group of tourists.
John bought their tickets to ride and noticed the captain at the helm inside. The only other boat employee aboard was an elderly humpback gentleman selling souvenirs, mostly daredevils, going over the falls in a barrel. "Lisa, I'm going to buy you a t-shirt commemorating our honeymoon to Niagara Falls. Pick the one of your choice." And John pointed to the small table covered with t-shirts. The elderly souvenir salesman heard John's encouraging offer to Lisa. He quickly spread out a colorful exhibit of a man waving from inside a wood-staved barrel floating upon the blue-green liquid at the fall's edge. "Here, ma'am, you can't go wrong with this one, and it's on sale today. You'll cherish this forever," said the aged gentleman, and he spread back his arms, protruded his chest, and showed that he wore the same design. "My wife of 50 years has this same shirt. We keep making this design year after year," said the elderly man. "Tourists, especially elderly, still married couples from all over the world, send us notes of thanks for being a part of their life experiences and their love for each other." And John noticed that the old salesman turned his head away from the crowd to wipe away emotional tears that had moistened his aging blue eyes set within his ruddy, suntanned face. Lisa chose the t-shirt of the old salesman's suggested design and held it up, covering her chest. "John, I do love this one, so I'll take it." She caressed the colorful white and aqua-printed Pima cotton shirt to her right cheek and savored this special moment. Cheerfully, she gave John a wide-open smile about a man and a barrel crossing over her chest. John gave the deformed elderly gentleman the money and thanked him for his kind service in making a just-married young lady happy. Once aboard Maid of the Mist, the two lovers donned raincoats with the rest of the tourists. "You look good in blue," said John, and he helped Lisa clasp the top button on her raincoat. "Better pull your hood up or you'll wind up with a head full of stringy wet hair," said John. Then he chuckled, hoping that Lisa could take a joke better than his wording on how to protect his wife. "We'll go rather close to the American Falls and the Horseshoe Falls later. There, should you want to, you'll have time to take some selfies," the captain said over the public address system. The newlyweds followed along with the 30 other people making their way to the platform beside the falls. Family groups of various combinations entertained themselves with taking their pictures in the pose of their choice. By chance, John turned and looked back down toward Maid of the Mist, docked several yards away, holding steady until the passengers returned. The captain leaned against the railing of the boat and looked back downstream toward the hydroelectric dam where the turbines turned the rushing water into electricity. Multicolored electric lights glowing within the mist formed an unusual atmosphere for the clutched-together passengers. Some held hands, and others, unabashedly, entwined in closer embraces. "Come here, John. Let's take one more picture before we have to move back to the dock," said Lisa, and she wiped clean the face of her smartphone. John's position for the selfie placed him looking toward the shadows inside Maid of the Mist, on the opposite end of the boat from the other passengers, where he now saw a tiny flame. At that same instant, an electric light bulb 3 feet above his head shattered. Glass shards hit onto his left shoulder. He'd misidentified the source of the tiny flame. "That was burning powder from a handgun," exclaimed John, and he picked up a fragment of the cartridge that had ricocheted against the metal stanchion holding one cord of the electric lights. "My guess is that fragment was from a Walther 25 caliber handgun," exclaimed John. "Furthermore, I think Andre Benelli pulled the trigger." "I didn't hear a shot," said Lisa, nervously putting her smartphone back into the dry inner pocket on her blue raincoat. "Neither did I hear a shot. But I saw its source through the window from Maid of the Mist," and John raised his voice louder, challenged by the roar of the falls to his back. "Sweetheart, there's only two people inside the boat, the captain and the old gentleman you bought my t-shirt from," said Lisa. The captain readied the controls of the boat, while the elderly souvenir salesman now puttered with a rack of t-shirts and necklaces he had for sale to anyone he missed on the way to the Bridal Veil Falls. A large stack of t-shirts rested on end of the table nearest the steps descending from the boat. John saw the old man lift the end of the table out of the way of any foot traffic. "Oh, my back!" yelped the old man, and John watched him hobble to the side of the boat hoarding various boat supplies. There, the bent-over elderly worker buckled on a wide black belt at his midriff to aid standing while trying to sell his last stack of wares illustrating the iconic picture of a man dressed in only a barrel going over Niagara Falls. John estimated the salesman's age to be about 90 years old, evidenced by his wrinkled face, sunken jaws, and frail structure. "I hope that I'm not still riding the back roads of South Louisiana looking for snakes to show to a new class of college freshmen when I'm that old," thought John to himself. And he felt sorry for the old man. "Surely one of those men wouldn't shoot toward us," said Lisa. "They're all involved in trying to get us back to the docking area. The captain is still inside, and the old salesman is tidying up his T-shirts."
"We hope that you have enjoyed your tour of Niagara Falls. It's time for us to debark," came the electronic call produced by the captain from the Maid of the Mist.
"Sweetheart, when we pull off these raincoats, we must be careful. That shot was no accident," declared John in his concerned utterance of precaution. "I think there is another person stashed away somewhere on that boat."
John and Lisa went to the front of the boat and took one last look toward all three falls. They stood along the front railing and looked toward the Horseshoe Falls on the Canadian side of Niagara Falls.
"John, the Horseshoe Falls are the largest of the Niagara Falls, so my pamphlet here says," and Lisa held the small sheet of paper up for John to see. But instead, she witnessed her husband in intense concentration toward the inside of the Maid of the Mist.
"Lisa, has it ever dawned on you that we may be in the company of Andre Benelli?"
With that word out of his mouth, Lisa stiffened, and her demeanor changed from that of gaiety to stark fear. Then she thought of all the threats made by Benelli while he slumped with his back to the antiquated Coke machine at the Gumbo House in St. Martinsville 5 years earlier.
"For Dr. Benelli to ruin our honeymoon would be his delight," said Lisa.
"Yes, it would, sweetheart, meaning that I couldn't even protect you on the most enjoyable night that married lovers might have in their lives," said John. "That would show his control over both of us, a slap at my masculinity and fear aimed toward your femininity.